In addition, he recently debated Benazir Bhutto, former Prime Minister of Pakistan. Jay is one of the leading Christian authorities on the historicity of early Islam and the Quran. And he currently resides with his wife and three sons in London. I think we are going to begin tonight with Mr. Smith. You're for 15 minutes, so. And I will not actually be stopping them. They have timers, but if you all go over more than 30 seconds or so, I have been alerted that I am to butt in.
Well, to you. Thanks. May the meditations of my mouth, meditations of my heart, be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength, and my redeemer. Good evening. Good, thank you. As we approach the dawn of the 21st century, after the death of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, this man, Jesus Christ, continues to fascinate the minds of thinking men and women around the world. The recent Peter Jennings special, In the Search of Jesus, attracted some 16 million viewers across the country. But who is Jesus really? Is he, as the Bible says, the divine Son of God? Or was he merely a human prophet, as Muslims have been taught to believe? Who is this real Jesus? And we're going to talk about that tonight. Now, I propose to answer that question as a historian. I shall look at the New Testament and at the Quran, and as the historians look at any other source for ancient history. I shall not treat them as inspired or holy books tonight, now, though I know myself and also my friend Shabir believe that they are inspired. Accordingly, I shall not require them to be inerrant or infallible in order to be valuable historical sources, at least not for tonight. By taking this historical approach, we prevent the debate from degenerating into arguments over Bible difficulties or Quranic inconsistencies. The question is not whether the sources are inerrant, but whether they allow us to discover an accurate portrait of the historical Jesus. Now, in order to determine who the historical Jesus really was, we need to have some objective criteria for assessing our sources. And what I'd like to use is Professor John Mayer, an eminent New Testament historian, who lists the following four criteria. First of all, multiple independent sources and early sources. Events which are reported by independent and especially early sources are likely to be historical. Dissimilarity is another one. If a saying or event is different from prior Judaism and also from later Christianity, then it probably doesn't derive from either one of the and so belongs to the historical Jesus. And examples of these would be the Son of Man issue, which I'll talk about later, the fact that Jesus called his God Father, Abba, or even that he was buried in a tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. These would be things that you would not find earlier with the Jewish writings, or certainly would not find later with the Christian writings. The third criteria will be embarrassment. Sayings or events that would have been embarrassing or difficult for the Christian church are unlikely to have been invented, and so are likely historical. Let me give you some examples of these. The baptism of Jesus would be an example of this, where it would have been difficult for the early church to have understood why Jesus, if he was sinless, needed to be baptized, because of the significance of what baptism meant. Some of the sayings of Jesus, for instance, his apocalyptic sayings, this would have been an embarrassment, because if this was the Son of God, why did he not know the end of times, or the date of the second coming, for instance, or the women's testimony there at the tombs, the fact that women were the ones that were the first ones to recognize or to come across the empty tombs. This would have been an embarrassment, and therefore would be a good criteria for understanding that they are likely historical. And then fourthly, rejection and execution. Jesus' crucifixion is so indisputably established as an anchor point in history that words and deeds of Jesus must be assessed in terms of their likelihood of leading to his execution as King of the Jews. A bland Jesus who just preached monotheism would never have provoked such an opposition. When we apply such criteria to the New Testament, we're able to establish a good deal about the historical Jesus. Let me discuss just three of the facts that emerge about this remarkable man, using those four criteria. First and foremost, Jesus' radical self-concept. The Quran says that Jesus thought of himself as no more than a human prophet who told people to worship the one true God. However, on the basis of this criteria, it can be shown that among the historically authentic words of Jesus are claims which reveal his divine self-understanding. Take, for example, Jesus' claim to be the Son of Man. The criteria for multiple sources and dissimilarity show it belongs to a historical Jesus. Now, most laymen probably think that this title refers to Jesus' humanity, just as the title Son of God refers to his deity, but that's a mistake. It fails to take into account the Jewish background of the expression, what the authors had intended to say. We must do that whenever we look into one of the sayings, or certainly that which we find in any scripture. In the Old Testament book of Daniel, chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, Daniel sees a vision of a divine human figure coming on the clouds of heaven, to whom God will give everlasting authority, glory, and dominion. No mere human being could be accorded such status, for this would be to commit the sin which Muslims call shirk, giving something which properly belongs to God alone to someone else. Yet this is the status which Jesus claimed for himself. Probably the most famous Son of Man saying by Jesus comes at his trial before the Jewish high priest, and I quote, "Then the high priest stood up and asked Jesus, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?' 'I am,' said Jesus, 'and you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven.' The high priest tore his clothes. 'You have heard blasphemy. What do you think?' They all condemned him as worthy of death." I get that from Mark 14, verses 60 to 64. Now, every Muslim sitting here would have to agree with the high priest and the council that Jesus is a blasphemer who is worthy of death because he had made himself equal with God by making those claims. Not only did Jesus claim to be the Son of Man, but he also thought of himself as the unique Son of God. Jesus' self-understanding as God's special Son comes to expression in his parable of the wicked tenants of the vineyard, which even the radical skeptical critics in the so-called Jesus seminar recognize as authentic. In this parable, the vineyard symbolizes Israel. The owner of the vineyard is God. The tenants are the Jewish religious leaders, and the servants are the prophets sent by God. In Mark 12, 1-9, we read, "A man planted a vineyard and rented it to some farmers. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, 'They will respect my son.' But the tenants said to one another, 'This is the heir, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours.' So they took him and they killed him." Mark 12, 1-9. Now, what does this parable tell us about Jesus' self-understanding? Well, it tells us four things. That Jesus thought of himself, first of all, as his beloved son. Secondly, that he thought of himself as distinct from all the other prophets. Thirdly, that he was God's final messenger. And fourthly, that he was heir to Israel. He did not think of himself as merely another human prophet, as Muslims like to believe. Jesus' self-concept as God's special son comes to explicit expression in Matthew 11, 27. "All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." It is unlikely the church invented this saying because it says that the Son is unknowable. No one knows the Son except the Father. But for the post-Easter church, we can know the Son. So by the criterion of dissimilarity, this saying is authentic. What does this saying then tell us about Jesus' self-concept? It tells us that he thought of himself as the exclusive Son of God and the only revelation of God to mankind. Now, this is really incredible. Think of what he is saying here. Understand of the importance of what he is doing. Yet this is what the historical Jesus believed. C.S. Lewis was right when he said, "A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. You can either shut him up as a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left us that open to us." Now, what's the second thing that Jesus said, about who he was? This is Jesus' trial and crucifixion. I'd like to go right into it. According to the Gospels, Jesus was condemned by the Jewish high court on the charge of blasphemy and then delivered to the Romans for execution for the treason of claiming to be king of the Jews. Not only are these facts confirmed by independent biblical sources like Paul and the Acts of the Apostles, but they are also confirmed by extra-biblical sources. From the Jewish historian Josephus and the Syrian writer Mara ben Bar Serapion, we learn that the Jewish leaders made a formal accusation against Jesus and participated in events leading up to his crucifixion. From the Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 43a, we learn that Jewish involvement in the trial was explained as a proper undertaking against the heretic. And from Josephus and the Roman historian Tacitus, we learn that Jesus was crucified by Roman authority under the sentence of Pontius Pilate. According to L.T. Johnson, a New Testament historian at Emory University, I think that's right here in Atlanta, the support for the mode of his death, its agent, and perhaps its co-agents is overwhelming. Jesus faced the trial before his death, was condemned, and executed by crucifixion. Perhaps the single most egregious historical error found in the Quran is its claim that Jesus was not in fact crucified. Not only is there not a single shred of evidence in favor of this remarkable hypothesis, but the evidence supporting Jesus' crucifixion is, as Johnson says, overwhelming. Those of you who are here tonight who are Muslims need to appreciate that no one who is not already a Muslim believes that the historical Jesus was not crucified. The crucifixion of Jesus is recognized even by the skeptical critics in the Jesus Seminar as, to quote Robert Funk, one indisputable fact. Indeed, Paula Fredrickson, whose book From Jesus to Christ inspired the PBS special by the same name, declares roundly, the crucifixion is the strongest single fact we have about Jesus. Thirdly, Jesus' resurrection. What happened to Jesus after his crucifixion? The majority of scholars who have written on this subject agree that three things happened. First of all, on the Sunday morning following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of women followers. Secondly, on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. And thirdly, the disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead despite their every predisposition to the contrary. I think the best explanation of these three facts is that the disciples were right. God had raised Jesus from the dead. This has enormous theological significance. For as the German theologian Wolfhart Pannenberg explains, the resurrection of Jesus acquires such decisive meaning not merely because someone or anyone has been raised from the dead, but because it is Jesus of Nazareth whose execution was instigated, because he had blasphemed against God. If this man was raised from the dead, then that plainly means that the God whom he had supposedly blasphemed has committed himself to him. In summary, on purely historical grounds, we have seen, one, that Jesus of Nazareth possessed a radical self-concept, the unique Son of God and also the Son of Man. Secondly, that he was tried, that he was condemned, and that he was crucified for his allegedly blasphemous claims. And thirdly, that God raised him from the dead in vindication of those claims. All this is in contradiction to the Quran's erroneous claims that Jesus thought of himself as a mere prophet, preaching a blasé monotheism, that he was not crucified, and that he did not raise from the dead. When you think about it, however, it's hardly surprising that the Quran gets the facts wrong about Jesus. You see, most scholars agree that the New Testament was written down within the first generation after the events it records, while the eyewitnesses to Jesus' life were still alive. This is significant, because they would have been still around to corroborate the events or sayings contained in the New Testament accounts. The Quran was written or compiled over 600 to 700 years later, not in Palestine, but in Arabia, with no independent historical source of information. That's why no historians today turn to the Quran as a historical source for studying the life of Jesus. Or I should say, few historians turn to the Quran today as a historical source for studying the life of Jesus. In fact, the Quran contains demonstrably legendary stories about Jesus which grew up during the centuries after his death. What am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to stories about Jesus which are found in the so-called apocryphal Gospels. These are forgeries which appeared in the second and third centuries after Christ, and which the Quran unwittingly repeats as facts, taking those stories and including them into the texts we find in the Quran today. For example, the Quran mentions the story borrowed from the forged document entitled The Infancy of Gospel of Thomas, of how the boy Jesus made a bird out of clay and then made it come to life. Such stories are legendary fictions. Thus the Quran, in contrast to the New Testament, is, if I may speak frankly, worthless as an independent historical source for Jesus. Thank you. Historically speaking, then, the answer to our question is clear. The real Jesus is the person described in the New Testament, not the legendary fabrication contained in the Quran. That's all I'll say at this time, Peggy. I just want to say in closing that the paper that I have just read was not written by me. It's not my material. It's actually Dr. William Craig's material. And I'm very happy to present it today. I wish he could be here to do it, because he's a much better man than I in this subject. But because of the situation that we have with Dr. Bedawi, I had to take it on for him. But I want to give credit where credit is due. And I leave this floor now over to Shabir Ali.
Mr. Ali, 10-minute rebuttal.
Thank you.
I begin with praise for the only true God, who was worshipped by Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. I ask him to send peace and blessings on all his prophets and messengers. In this part of our debate, my task is to answer this question. Who is the true Jesus? Is he the Jesus of the Bible? I've also to support my answer with reason, with evidence, and proof. First, a clarification of terms. According to the NIV Bible Dictionary, the word Christ means the same as the word Messiah. Hence, we can exchange one for the other. I will now examine the image of Jesus as crucified Messiah. This is the image most present, most prominent in the writings of Paul, the most influential writer in the New Testament. Paul says, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles." 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23 in the NIV. Now here is the problem. A crucified Christ is a contradiction in terms. By definition, the Messiah has to be victorious over his enemies. What happens if he is killed by the enemy? In his paper, The Evidence for the Resurrection, Jay writes, and I quote him, "The rule was that if your Messiah was killed, then obviously he was not the true Messiah." End of quote. So then, if Jesus was killed, then obviously he was not the true Messiah. If he was the true Messiah, he couldn't be crucified. If he was crucified, he couldn't be the true Messiah. Jay may say, "No problem, Shabir. Jesus rose from the dead, so he is the true Messiah after all." And I would say, "Okay, Jay, bring your proof." If Jay proves that Jesus rose from the dead, then I must reverse my judgment. But until Jay proves it, I should keep believing that a crucified Messiah is as self-refuting as a square circle, a four-sided triangle, or a married bachelor. Now, this is the proof that Jay should have concentrated on. Instead, he spends his time telling us that, you know, Jesus claimed this or that, or how can we discover the true words of Jesus, and that Jesus was definitely crucified according to the judgment of Roman historians and all of that. He states this as the one indisputable fact. But the one indisputable fact we need to find out is that he resurrected from the dead, and this is what Jay has to provide evidence for. Instead, he resorts to referring to the Quran as legendary fabrication, which I take offense with. But notice this. Paul wrote, "If Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is useless, and your believing it is useless." 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 14. So everything hangs on this one simple question: was Jesus raised from the dead? Now let me look at the evidence for the resurrection to see if there is any hope that Jay could actually persuade us tonight, or that anyone can persuade us that Jesus actually rose from the dead. I will show that the gospel evidence is marred by contradiction and doubt. Let me begin with the first of the four gospels. Dr. William Lane Craig writes, "Mark is the earliest of our gospels." So let's look at that gospel. What is the total evidence in this gospel that Jesus reappeared to his disciples? Jesus' body is missing from his tomb. A young man in white clothes said that Jesus is raised and will be seen in Galilee. Mark does not say that this man is an angel and does not describe the actual reappearance of Jesus. You see the actual lack of evidence. Even here where it says that Jesus is going to reappear in Galilee is in a verse which, according to Wolfhart Pannenberg, is not in the pre-Markan gospel narrative, or the pre-Markan passion narrative. And notice that Jay referred to Wolfhart Pannenberg as an authority on these matters. So according to that, then we have no evidence in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus ever resurrected or appeared to anyone. Let me continue. This is why many hands came adding verses to Mark to boost the evidence. Some added a short ending. Some added a long ending. You'll find some of these in your Bibles. Some added a short and a long ending, and some added a piece into the long ending to make it longer. Bruce Metzger, the recognized textual expert, shows that anything after verse 8 is a later addition. This is in his book, The Text of the New Testament, Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration, page 226. Now, not being satisfied with Mark, others wrote new and improved Gospels. Matthew improves the story by supplying guards at the tomb to assure us that no one could have stolen the body. But, as Raymond Brown points out, if there were guards at the tomb, as described in Matthew, the other Gospels would make little sense. The NIV Bible commentary says, "We do not hesitate to speak of Matthew's changes of, additions to, and omissions from Mark. Each writer comes up with his own improved version, and the versions contradict each other. According to Matthew, Jesus appeared to his disciples in Galilee, but according to Luke, the disciples were in Jerusalem all this time, some 90 miles away from the scene of the sighting." The best of today's New Testament scholars admit this problem. In our last debate, Jay insisted that I should take my information from Raymond Brown. Brown writes, "It is quite obvious that the Gospels do not agree as to where and to whom Jesus appeared after his resurrection." That's in the Anchor Bible Commentary, volume 29A, page 969. Jay may say these variations prove that the writers did not all agree to tell the same lie. But it also shows that they didn't get their facts right. John chapter 20 shows that the disciples often sat around discussing these events. In the end, they should all have the same information. If they wrote the Gospels, or even supplied the information for the Gospels would not contradict each other on such fundamental issues. In principle, Jay admits that the Bible has problems. After trying hard to resolve 101 cleared up contradictions, or 101 contradictions in the Bible, Jay and others write on their final page that the remaining problems can be counted on your fingers and toes. To me, that means that there are more than 10 problems. I conclude, we cannot believe these contradictory reports about who saw Jesus and where. Another problem. The Gospels try to prove that Jesus reappeared, yet they often show that Jesus could not be positively identified. Matthew's Gospel says that the disciples saw Jesus and worshipped him, but some doubted. Matthew 28:17. The Living Bible says, "But some of them weren't sure it really was Jesus." The New American Bible reads, "But they doubted," which means they all doubted. The doubt is not always mentioned, to be sure, but in 101 Cleared Up Contradictions in the Bible, page 48, Jay and others write that this passage is a summary of all the appearances of Christ. This allows me to conclude that in summary, the disciples were not sure they really saw Jesus. Acts of the Apostles in the Bible shows the disciples speaking as though they had seen Jesus, but according to the editors of the New American Bible, the author of Acts has put these words into the mouths of the apostles, of the disciples, rather. According to a popular myth, the cross killed the faith of the disciples, but the resurrection revived their faith. But here are the facts. The disciples did not need the resurrection to fuel their faith. After the crucifixion, they continued to believe in Jesus as a great prophet. On the other hand, Paul's faith was fueled by a vision in which Jesus authorized him as an apostle. But this vision is questionable for many reasons. Here are them. First, Paul did not know Jesus enough to make a positive identification. Second, Paul opposed Peter to his face. And who was Peter? Authorized by Paul, according to Matthew 16. Third, Barnabas sided with Peter and split from Paul. Fourth, Paul's followers in Galatia and Corinth seriously questioned his authority. And fifth, Paul's authority is recognized in the second letter of Peter, but according to Bruce Metzger, this letter was not written by Peter, but by someone else using Peter's name. Nevertheless, Paul went on to become the most influential writer of the New Testament. Paul's crucified Messiah is the dominant image of Jesus in the Bible. It is this image that I reject. It is as self-refuting as a square circle, a four-sided triangle, or a married bachelor. Recall what Jay wrote. The rule was that if your Messiah was killed, then obviously he was not the true Messiah. If he was the Messiah, he couldn't be crucified. If he was crucified, he couldn't be the Messiah. Jay can advance many arguments, and my reply will follow. But since we have proved now that the evidence for Jesus' reappearance is seriously flawed, every other argument fails. Hence, Old Testament prophecies fail. New Testament prophecies fail. The empty tomb proves nothing. And 1 minute, then I will conclude. If Jay cannot argue for the resurrection, speaking about these other topics that he's spoken about is really pointless. I leave you with these words of Paul. If Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is useless, and your believing it is useless. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 14. All we have so far, and all that we can see, is that if you look at the Bible, we have evidence, or lack of evidence, rather, and the evidence that is there shows that there were some conflicting reports of unconfirmed and unidentified sightings. I leave it to Jay to give us some real evidence.
Thanks, Shepard. He's good, isn't he? He does this all the time to me. I wish William Craig was up here. Now, what are we going to do with Shabir? Well, Shabir, first and foremost, I think you need to be careful when you say that the resurrection is not confirmed. It has been confirmed. We went through some of those, and you try to find contradictions with them. Now, let me give you a little background as to why Shabir is referring to this 101 contradictions. This is a paper that we've given back and forth to each other. Shabir came up with 101 contradictions in our Bible, and quite a few of them focused on the resurrection. It's one of his favorite topics. So a group of us got together, and we decided to answer every one of these 101 contradictions. We slapped cleared up contradictions, and we slapped it back to him. And this is what he's referring to. All of those contradictions can be cleared up. The problems that you're finding is not with the contradictions. The problems you're quoting about on your hands and fingers were your problems. That's what we stated very clearly at the end of the paper. You basically made 15 errors over and over again in the 101 contradictions. For those of you who want to read this, you can go up on our website and pull it down. I'm not going to waste my time today to try to understand and try to put together every one of the contradictions, because there's a plethora of supposed contradictions in the Bible that have been around for over 100 years. Many of the ones that Shabir likes to refocus in on are nothing new, and they've all been answered very well, not only by us, but by others much more wiser than we are. Now, what about the problem of the Messiah and Christ? How could you have Christ, Christos, and the Messiah, the same word, dying? Well, I think we need to go back to the Old Testament. We need to go back to passages like Psalm 22. You need to go back to passages like Isaiah 53. You need to go back to passages like Psalm 69. Because when you go back to those passages, they refer to the Messiah, and they refer to the coming that not just once, but two different times. The first time coming as a suffering servant, and the second time coming as a triumphant king. And this is what you find in the Old Testament, Shabir. So therefore, there was an expectation that the first coming of the Messiah would be as a suffering servant. And if you can't get it more clear than Isaiah 53, the first verses that you find there in Isaiah 53, where he would come and with his stripes we would be healed. This is the expectation that the Jews had of the Messiah. Unfortunately, they didn't read their own scriptures. There are still many Jews today that are still looking for a triumphant entrance of their Messiah. If you look back at the Old Testament, there is no problem whatsoever with understanding that that Messiah would come as a suffering servant. And only then the second time would he come as a triumphant king. Okay, you see, there's not a contradiction there. The proofs of the resurrection, we talked quickly about them. The empty tomb, you say there was no empty tomb. If there was no empty tomb, why was no body ever found? To this day, no one has been able to come up with a body, neither the Jews, neither the Romans. To this day, the tomb is still empty. If that's not proof of the resurrection, I don't know what is. But you need to go back to the witnesses. You say that they had a difficult time understanding who Jesus was or recognizing him. I don't see that when I read the scriptures. I don't see where you're going with that. There are many different instances in 1 Corinthians 15 that talk not only about those disciples that saw him, but over 500 who saw him at one time. They knew who their Christ was. They'd been with him for 3 years. Of course they recognized who he was. This was not a problem. It's not a problem for them. It's not a problem for me. And of course, then you need to ask, why is it that they then changed their lives because of that resurrection? Because see, every one of the disciples, many of them were just men like you and me. Some of them were not learned. Some of them were just fishermen. They had no reason to give up everything that they believed and to follow a man, and to follow a man who not only died and so supposedly had broken up everything that they had believed in, but then who rose again triumphantly and brought back to basically everything that they then based their whole lives on. Because what we know about the disciples is that every one of them died for this, except for one. They all died for this belief. Would they have died? Would they have given themselves their lives because they didn't believe Christ had risen again? Certainly not. And I forget what was the last one. Can somebody help me here? Was there any other question that I missed here? How much more time do I have? Okay, 1 minute. Let me just finish and just say, As a Christian, I need to go back and I need to see 1 Corinthians 15. I need to go back and I need to see those who have gone before me. And I need to go back and I need to look at their testimony and their witness. Here were these disciples. They were following a man. They believed they knew what this man was doing. And yet this man suddenly is crucified in front of them, comes back and appears to them, walks right through the wall, appears to them and shows them as the resurrected Jesus Christ. The man they saw on the cross now was resurrected. What would it do to you if you were in their presence? I hope it would change your lives like it changed the lives of those disciples. Because it was because of that one act in history that everything has changed. It's because of that one act in history, because of the resurrection, that Christianity is what it is today. And because of that one fact that many of you who are sitting here today know and are sure, just like the disciples back then 2,000 years ago, that Christ did not only die, he rose again. That is an assured fact for them. It is an assured fact for me. I don't see any contradiction in that. I don't know why, Chubbitt, you can't see it as well. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Ollie, you're looking for something. Take your time. Mr. Ollie.
Thank you. It's amazing. I don't know where I left my 15-minute speech. I guess I'll just have to go with my Bible and my wits.
It has to be wrong.
All right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Don't get too worried, Jay. Okay, I'll get started. Fine. Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
Now, my task in this part of the debate is to answer this question. Who is the true Jesus? Is he the Jesus of the Quran? Now, as I did in the last time, I will focus now on a dominant image of Jesus. In the last speech, I focused on the dominant image of Jesus in the Bible as crucified Christ. Now, I won't reply to everything that Jay Smith said now, because I'll come back towards the end for closing conclusions, and then I can reply to some of the points. But you can see that in some summary way, I've already done a good reply to him, because I said that if Jesus did not reappear, then every other argument fails. If you say the Old Testament said he was going to reappear, but he didn't reappear, then the Old Testament prophecy failed. And if you say that the disciples surely knew him, so they couldn't have doubted, well, then you're adding to my argument. Because if they knew him, and when they saw him, they couldn't recognize him, as I've showed from an actual verse in the Bible, Matthew chapter 28, verse 17, well, then that proves that there is something seriously wrong. Jesus did not look like Jesus. Now, Jay seems to have forgotten what he has written, because he said that the problems he was referring to are my remaining problems. But I don't think so, because in his book here, in pages 55 to 56, he says that the Bible is not divided against itself. Jesus was talking about a major division, that is, Satan destroying his own demons. This is far removed from the Bible, a book four times the size of the Quran, with the remaining problems able to be counted on your fingers and toes. So those are not my remaining problems. They are remaining problems in the Bible, according to his words. But of course, he might have forgotten that. No problem, Jay. Now, I want to defend this position that Jesus, as a prophet, is the true Jesus. I'd like to show that this is the original Jesus, and that is the major point that the Quran speaks about. Now, the Quran also calls him Messiah, and that may lead to some confusion. Just as I started my last talk by defining showing that Messiah means Christ, I would like at this point to go a little bit more into some detail on that. According to the NIV Bible Dictionary, Messiah means one who is anointed. Now, this term can refer to, according to the Oxford Companion to the Bible, either a prophet or a priest or a king. So the Quran, in referring to Jesus as the Messiah, is actually referring to him as a prophet, as Jeffrey Parender, a Christian writer on the Quran, has shown in his book, Jesus in the Quran. So Jesus in the Quran is a prophet. Now, in what sense is the title Messiah applicable to a prophet? According to the NIV Bible Dictionary again, the word Messiah can be used for anything or any person that is consecrated for the service of God. And since Jesus was consecrated for the service of God, Muslims would believe in him to be a chosen person, as we might say in the Arabic language, a Mustafa. And the term for that in the Hebrew language is Messiah, that was used to refer to such consecrated things. So Jesus was a prophet right from the very beginning. According to the New Jerome Biblical Commentary, on page 1323, you can always check me up on that, Jay. New Jerome Biblical Commentary, Jesus actually identified himself as a prophet if the Gospel of Luke is true. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus went into the synagogue, he opened up his Bible and he started to read from Isaiah chapter 61, where it says that God has anointed me to give good news to the Gentiles. So in that case, Jesus is a prophet, identifying himself as an anointed prophet. According to this New Jerome Biblical Commentary, there is no one single view of what the Messiah should be. He could be a priest, he could be a prophet, he could be a king. So then, if Jesus identified himself as described here in the Gospel according to Luke, then the New Jerome Biblical Commentary says, in that case, he would be a Messiah. So now that we've cleared that up, how did Jesus get from prophet to Son of God and to divine second person of the Holy Trinity? I'd like to explain that. If we look at the Gospels today, which are the, and my talk is not about the Gospels, it is about the Quran. But what we have to do is we want to find out how did this get from prophet to Son of God and to God. Now, every historian has to go back to the Gospels, as Jay himself has described. John Mayer actually describes how we can differentiate between what is originally from Jesus and what is not. So I will use some of these methods, which are applied by modern historians, and look at the four Gospels. Remember we said before, according to Dr. William Lane Craig, the first of the four Gospels is what? Gospel according to Mark. According to Jay and his colleagues in the same book that I referred to earlier on, John is the last of the four Gospels written around the year 90. So we go from Mark to John, and with Matthew and Luke in between. What happens...
To encourage you to speak about the Jesus of the Quran and not of the Gospels, if you don't mind.
I don't know why this instruction should come at this point, because I am actually speaking about the Jesus of the Quran and to prove the contention. This is my task at the moment, to prove the contention that the Jesus of the Quran is the true Jesus.
Can you talk about the Jesus of the Quran as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what I've done so far, if you've been listening to me, folks, is that I've said that the Jesus of the Quran is a prophet. And when I spoke about the Jesus of the Bible, I spoke about Jesus being crucified Messiah. That is the dominant image of Jesus in the Bible. My task there was to prove that this image is incorrect. I think I've done that. My task at the moment is not to prove that the Gospels are incorrect or that the Bible is incorrect. My task at the moment is, as a historian, using the methods that Jay has already outlined for our study tonight, is to find out if the Quranic image of Jesus as prophet and Messiah is correct. And since, as Jay pointed out, the Quran came some 600 years after the Bible, historians do not turn to the Quran for historical information about Jesus. This is well known in biblical studies. So if somebody in the background is saying, this is very strange, I would have to say, be assured, don't be afraid. I mean, if the truth comes out tonight, we should all accept it. Look, I mean, if Jesus of the Bible is true, I'm willing to accept him. And if the Jesus of the Quran is true, I expect the same of all of you. So now, if we turn to an examination of how Jesus came to be represented as something else, then we can see why he is being represented not as prophet anymore, because I want to prove the contention that prophet was the original designation. Now, we look at the Gospel according to John, which is the last of the four to be written. Historians are well agreed that the Gospel according to John do not always provide us with historical information about Jesus. For example, the sayings of Jesus, which promote his divinity in the Gospel according to John, are held to be highly suspect. For example, all of the I am sayings, I am this or I am that. John is said to be a more developed theology. When we go back to Mark, there we find a very human Jesus. And we find that the later gospel writers tried to modify that information and improve the image of Jesus over time. I can give several examples for that. But I have some notes from Bruce Metzger, who himself has given some examples. And I know from our last debate that Bruce Metzger is regarded as a reputable scholar by my colleague Jay Smith. So I'd like to share with you some thoughts from Bruce Metzger, if I can find them very quickly. And this is what Bruce Metzger writes about in his book, The New Testament, Its Background, Growth, and Content, on pages 81 to 83. Metzger writes, Matthew and Luke suppress or weaken references in Mark to such human emotions of Jesus as grief and anger and amazement, as well as Jesus' unrequited love. They also omit Mark's statement that Jesus' friends thought he was beside himself. Now, Metzger writes, the later Gospels omit what might imply that Jesus was unable to accomplish what he willed. Matthew and Luke do not include these statements of Mark. Mark says that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, according to 1:45. He meant to pass them by, implying that he did not do what he meant to do. Mark chapter 6, verse 48. Metzger writes that Matthew and Luke also omit questions asked by Jesus, which might be taken to imply his ignorance. Metzger also writes that Matthew and Luke soften Mark's statements, which might lessen the majesty of Jesus and heighten what illustrates the majesty of Jesus. As an example of this, Metzger shows that when Jesus cursed the fig tree, according to Mark, the disciples did not notice the withering until next morning. But in Matthew, the tree withered at once, and the disciples were amazed at the sudden withering. So you see the heightening of the image of Jesus here. And again, no one should mind that I'm discussing here something about the Gospels. Recall that when Jay spoke about the Bible, he spoke about the Quran being legendary fiction. What did you say, Jay? Yeah, something like that. And, you know, he made some other references to the Quran as being borrowed from infancy narratives and so on. So, you know, we're trying to prove our contentions, and I hope that you will bear with me on that. Metzger also writes, here and there, the phrasing adopted by Matthew and Luke in reporting Jesus' words seemed to reflect a later stage of theological understanding than that in Mark. In other words, Matthew and Luke were changing the words of Jesus to make Jesus say what Matthew and Luke wanted people to believe. One of the examples that Metzger gave is the parable of the vineyard that Jay himself spoke about earlier on. If you look at Mark's depiction of the parable of the vineyard, what happened to the man who came to claim the rent? He was killed and then thrown out of the city. But we know that if this refers to Jesus, Jesus had to be thrown out of the city first and then killed. And so Matthew and Luke modify to have it that the man is thrown out of the city first and then killed. You see, the later the gospel, the more it becomes very Christian right before our very eyes. So now, let's deal with the question that is often put to the Quran. How does the Quran have information which seems to come from apocryphal gospels like the infancy gospel of Thomas and the proto-evangelium of James? Doesn't that prove that the Quran has a very human origin and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, just simply copied this from legendary fictions, as Jay would say? I don't think so. Because if you think of how the Bible was canonized, you realize that there were a lot of debates in the early centuries about which books should be included and which books should not. Moreover, the books that were eventually excluded cannot be said to be totally fictitious. Even Norman Geisler, in his book Introduction to the Bible, which he co-authored with the Nix, says that these Gospels may have some true information in them. And he said, truth is truth. We should accept it from wherever it comes. Why was he forced to admit that as a biblical inerrantist? Because he realizes that some of the New Testament writings themselves quote from some of these apocryphal writings. Raymond Brown himself, in his book Introduction to the New Testament, tells us plainly that there are quotations here in the New Testament from 1st Enoch, which is not in the Bible, and from the Assumption of Moses, both of which are apocryphal and pseudonymous works. So if that proves something wrong against the Quran, well, what does it do to the Bible? I would submit that Christians cannot and should not use arguments against the Quran which would rebound against the Bible, because then you're just trying to disprove both books, and it doesn't seem like we'll make any progress that way, except towards atheism. Now, the one historical fact, according to Jay, is that Jesus was definitely crucified. But wait a minute, does that prove the Quran to be wrong? No, what is established in history is that there was a crucifixion, Jesus was seen on the cross, this is what the eyewitnesses could say. The Quran does not deny this historical eyewitness, because what the Quran actually says is that ما قتلوه, they killed him not, وما صلبوه, they did not crucify him, ولكن شبه لهم, but it was made so to appear to them. So it appeared to them that they had Jesus on the cross, but the Quran says, وَإِنَّ الَّذِينَ اخْتَلَفُوا فِيهِ لَفِي شَكٍ مِّنْ, and those who differed concerning him were in doubt concerning him. وَمَا قَتَلُوهُ يَقِينًا, they didn't kill him for certain. They were not sure. Now you see, the problem is that if you say he was the Messiah, and if you say that the people were sure that they killed him, what should they believe? They should believe this is not the true Messiah. They should believe we proved him false by crucifying him, so we should never believe him. But they might say, but wait a minute, Jesus came back from the dead and reappeared to his disciples. But notice that when he reappeared, according to the narratives that we have, which are contradictory and cannot be believed, if they were to be believed, they actually show that Jesus was not positively identified. So Jay has to deal with the one reference which I gave to the Bible showing that there is this lack of positive identification. Unless he does that, we must believe that Jesus did not reappear from the dead. And if you stress the historicity of the crucifixion, you're just shooting yourself in the foot. So now let's think back where this debate has come so far. We looked at the Jesus of the Bible, and we saw that this is a self-contradicting Jesus. He's self-refuting. A self-refuting is a square circle, or a four-sided triangle, or a married bachelor. If he was the Messiah, he couldn't be crucified. If he was crucified, he couldn't be the Messiah. You can't have your cake and also eat it. Now, Jay might say, but wait a minute, he resurrected from the dead. And I'm saying, prove it. Show that he resurrected from the dead. He must appear. The empty tomb by itself is not going to prove anything. Just like you have an empty morgue, it doesn't mean that somebody has resurrected from the dead. So now, finally, in closing, was Jesus a prophet? Was he the Messiah? Yes, he was both things, as asserted by the Quran. We can see that the original belief in Jesus was that of prophet, as described in Luke's Gospel. In early Christianity, there was a split between Gentile Christianity and Jewish Christianity. Jewish Christianity, 1 minute more. Jewish Christianity did not survive for very long, but the influences and teachings in Jewish Christianity that Jesus was a prophet, a messenger of God, that survived and was reborn later on in the religion of Islam, a revelation from the Almighty God, and that is the image that we have of Jesus in the glorious Quran, the original and true Jesus. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Well, I hope you're convinced. I didn't hear too much on the Quran there. I was still waiting. I was taking notes. I only have two lines there persuading me that Jesus was Jesus, the correct view of Jesus, could come from the Quran. But let me just take on some of the things you were saying, and then let me go and tell you why I believe the Quran has some real problems with Jesus Christ. First and foremost, you say that the stories that we do have, that you find in the Quran about Jesus, are borrowed from the apocryphal accounts, that this is not a problem, because they were also used by some of the early church. Let's look at some of those stories, and let's just see what the Quran does borrow. Because when you go back to the Quran, you will find that there's some interesting stories that those of us who are Christians here, we do recognize are derived. Ayah 30, the story of Abraham, 27. The story of Cain and Abel is probably a good one to use, because here we can get an idea of what is happening with these apocryphal or Talmudic accounts, Jewish Talmudic accounts. In Surah 531, it refers to the fact that when Cain had killed Abel, he didn't know what to do with the body, and so he looks around and sees a raven scratching in the ground, and he uses that example to bury his brother. Then the next verse suddenly talks about the blood of Abel, and it refers to the fact that if one man is killed, it is if all are killed. And if all are killed, it is if one man is killed. It seems on a redemption analysis, what is it doing in the Quran? It should not be there. Well, if you look back at the Targum of Jonathan ben Uzai, you will find that story about the raven. If you look at the Targum of Jerusalem, you will find the same story about that raven. These are 3rd and 4th century documents. We know who wrote them. We know when they were written. What is very curious is when you get to the Mishnah Sanhedrin number 4-5, you will find that an editorial comment about the blood of Abel is written in the margins. And then it is incorporated into the text in the Mishnah Sanhedrin in the 5th century. Now, interestingly, the story about the raven plus the editorial comments about the blood of Abel is then incorporated into the next copy, and it is this story plus its editorial comment that makes its way into the Quran in the 7th or 8th century. Can you see why we're bringing these up, Shabir? You cannot have pieces of literature that were considered to be apocryphal pieces of literature, they were not considered to be part of the canon, written by men, for men, in the Quran, if it claims to be the divine book of God, the final revelation, Surah 43. There's other stories. I can talk to you about Abraham, Surah 21. Here's Abraham smashing some idols. He's thrown into a fiery pit. It's a good story. It's not in my Bible. Where do you think it comes from? I can tell you where it comes from. It comes from the Midrash of Rabbah. Again, another 4th century document. One of the great stories I love is the story of Solomon and Sheba. This is a terrific story. Here's King Solomon. He has some birds. He trains up. The hoop of birds missing. He gets angry. Where's that hoop of bird? It comes flying from the south. It's seen a beautiful queen in the south. He goes and sends a hoop of bird back to look at that, to go back to that queen to tell that her to come up and visit him. She comes up to visit him there in Jerusalem, comes into his throne room. He has a mirrored floor. She's never seen a mirrored floor before. She lifts up her skirt. A great story. Is it in your Bible? It's not in mine. Where is it from? Do you know where it's from, Shabir? Do you know where it's from? Almost the exact same story for word can find in Targum of Esther. What are these targums in these Mishnahs? They are apocryphal accounts. These are Jew fables. They're folk tales. They were written in the 4th and 5th century, and they were written in the vernacular of that place and that time. Therefore, they would have been easily accessible to the Arabs in the 7th century. Now, why is it that the Arabs, or whoever was that put the Quran together, did not go back to the original Bible and get the authentic tales? Well, one very good reason. The Bible had not yet been translated into Arabic. It wasn't translated until the 8th century. No wonder they were dependent on these stories. These stories were not considered to be canonical. These stories were never considered to be part of the Bible as such. They were only there for entertainment, or they're there for fables that they were brought in from surrounding nations, and yet they find their way into the Quran. Is the Quran a divine sanction? Was it sent down by God? Not with these kind of fables inside. But see, it even gets worse. Not only did they borrow from surrounding nations, we now know that the Quran probably did not even exist at the time of Muhammad, or it existed the time immediately after Muhammad. Because what Muslims tell us is that the Quran was sent down, tanzil, to a man named Muhammad in the early part of the 7th century, and then it was written down after his death, right within 2 years of his death, at the time of Abu Bakr, between 632 and 634, but it had to be rewritten again at the time of Uthman, the third caliph, in around 650, mid-7th century. Now, the question I always ask my Muslim friends is, where are these manuscripts that were written down? Because according to tradition, according to the hadith, and according to the Siddha of the Prophet, and also according to the Tahriq, it says that there were four copies were made at the time of Uthman. One was sent to Basra, another was sent to Baghdad, and one was sent to Damascus, and one was left there in Medina. So therefore, we should have these documents from which we can look at, right? And I always ask my Muslim friends, where are they? And they point to two manuscripts that are probably the most popular, the Topkapi manuscript and the Samarkand manuscript, which can be found in the Topkapi Museum in Istanbul, or the Samarkand in Tashkent in Uzbekistan. You can go and look at them. But when you look at these documents, you see that there's a problem right away. These documents have the wrong script. They are not written in a script that would have been in existence in the 7th century. They are written in a script that is in existence and only came into existence in the mid-8th century. How do we know that? Well, we go to the coins. And if you ever come to London, I'll take you on a tour there, not all of you at once, but I'll take you on a tour of the British Museum, and you can go to room number 68, panel number 12, and you will see the chronology of the coins there on the panels. And it comes down from the Sufyani period down to the Marwani period, and you get the coins down to the Abbasid period, the mid-8th century, and suddenly the script changes. At the beginning, you'll find a Hijazi script. Now, you know what a Hijazi script is, I hope. A Hijazi script can be recognized because it has long aleph, so it has slanted aleph, and it is not a parallel script. It's a much earlier script. And you will find that the coins that have the Hijazi script are not the same script that we find in these documents. It's not until we get to the Abbasid script, which is very easy to recognize because it is parallel. It does have justification. It has a much more uniform type of lettering. This kind of script is found on the coins that were introduced in the mid-8th century by the Abbasids. Why? For one very good reason. They didn't have things like this, television and radio, to announce when they came into power, but they did use coins. And when they came into power, as they did in the mid-8th century, they brought the capital from Damascus down to Baghdad. These were Persians, the Abbasids. They wanted to introduce who they were. So they introduced not only their own coins, but they introduced their own script. And it is this script that we find in the Topkapi. It is this script that we find in the Samarkand. That means you have at least 100 years gap where we can't find any Quran. At least we thought that was the case until just recently. In 1970s, some new manuscripts were found in a place called Sana'a in Yemen. Now, these are manuscripts that had not been discovered before. They were hidden away up between in a dome of the mosque there in Sana'a. And suddenly, 12,000 of them fell down when some workmen were working on them. The people who came across them didn't know how to read them. So they had two German scholars, Dr. Gerhard Puin and Dr. von Wolfmer, fly down there to Yemen to look at these manuscripts. And immediately they realized that they had something on their hands here, because they recognized that, one of the manuscripts had this Hijazi script, the very script that you would expect to find in the 7th century. They took pictures of it. Those pictures they put onto microfilms. They only were given those microfilms in 1997. They've only had 3 years to look at it. Now, I've seen Dr. Gerhard Puin. I've talked to him face to face, and he's told me some things about those scripts which I cannot say today because he's not yet published it. But let me tell you what he has told me and what is published that is available for you to listen. Just let me tell you what they found in those manuscripts. First of all, more than half of the text is made up of ambiguous letters which need diacritical marks for an understanding. Secondly, there's an unconventional verse ordering, minor textual variations, and rare styles of orthography in this manuscript. Thirdly, many of the deviations are not mentioned in later literature. Many of the deviations they find in the Quran, this particular manuscript, are not mentioned in later literature. And the differences are even meaningful in a theological sense. But probably most devastating is the fact that a good bit of the Quran is missing. It's not the fact that it's just missing because it's been lost or eaten by a goat or burnt by some individual. Dr. Quinn showed me one page of this Quran, and it has Surah 19 that comes halfway down the page, and then it jumps to Surah 22. What happened to Surah 20 and 21? And that's not the only place. Excuse me. There are other places between a jump between Surah 26 and 37, between Surah 67 and Surah 71. They're just missing. Now, when he looked at the text, and when he looked at the script that was in the text, he was able to date this to 705, between 705 and 715. That means this would be the earliest manuscript we have of the Quran. It would predate the Topkap in the Samarkand by at least 50 to 60 years. What does that tell you? Well, what it tells me is that what we have here, we finally have manuscript evidence that shows that the Quran evolved. It did not come down complete at one time in the mid-7th century. As late as the early 8th century, we're finding already deviations. We're finding complete surahs that are missing. It's not until we get to the Samarkand and the Topkapi, which have been proven not to be even 8th century documents, but 9th century documents, that we finally see a full Quran that is parallel to the Cairene text that we use today. But hold on a minute. Thank you. I was waiting for that. Perfect timing. Can we do that again?
30 seconds.
Here we go. And I'm about ready to conclude, because even when we look at the Samarkand document, we now have done studies on it, and this is interesting. I've not yet met one Muslim that has done a study on the Samarkand document, or the Topkapi, or the 2165 Ma'il document, or the Sana manuscript. None of the Muslims want to talk about their Quran, just as Shabir Ali didn't want to talk about his Quran. Why? Because when you look at that Samarkand document, and it has been done, we find that only 33% of the Quran is there. And amongst that 33%, we can find already 100 manuscript variants from the Cairene text that we have today. No wonder people do not want to go to the Quran to find out who Jesus Christ is. We're not even sure that this Quran was even in existence in the 7th century. I have no idea whether Muhammad ever knew much of the Quran that we talk about coming from divinely inspired by him. Do you see the difficulty that we're having? You've got to do a historical application. And when you start doing that, you suddenly realize that which Islam is dependent upon does not have any authority for the time period from which they claim. And I've got to stop there. We'll continue later.
Shabir Ali now has 5 minutes.
Thank you. Jay said right from the very start that our topic tonight is not about whether we have the true and authoritative and right scriptures. And he was correct. But then he shifted gears, and in this last speech, what he really spoke about is that Muslims do not have the right Quran. But folks, that's not our topic. Because if we have the wrong Quran, but in that Quran the image of Jesus that we read about as prophet and Messiah is the true Jesus, never mind if the book is wrong, but if the Jesus is right, then my position is proved. And that is our topic. Now, to prove that I had the right Jesus in the Quran, forget about where the book came from, I showed that the position of Jesus in the Quran, the dominant image of him, is of prophet and Messiah. I went into the etymological derivative of this word to find out where this word came from and why it could apply to Jesus. I went into the history of the belief that Jesus is a prophet. I looked at Luke's gospel. I looked at what Jesus himself demonstrated, which is thought to be historically true. He went into the synagogue and he read before the people a document from the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah, designated himself as a prophet. Notice the authorities that I quoted from. I didn't quote from people you do not know, but I quoted from recognized authorities, like the New Jerome Biblical Commentary. I quoted from the Oxford Companion to the Bible, which is edited by Bruce Metzger, a man who Jay respects. I quoted from the NIV Bible Dictionary, a book that many of you read. On the other hand, to prove his points, Jay comes to me with a quote from some German scholar that I do not know. Now, if Jay won't believe his scholars, why does he expect me to believe his German scholars? I also showed in my last speech that the image of Jesus was originally that of prophet, but eventually the documents that were written about him tried to promote him to the level of divine Son of God. And what I've shown there is that the Quran is actually true. Now you might say the Quran was written some 600 years later, but if this is a revelation from the Almighty God, you can see why the Quran has the correct information that was there from 600 years ago, which eventually got covered up under layers and layers of traditions and gospels, new and improved versions that were written over time. My point was not to prove that the gospels are wrong. That is not our topic. But my point was to find out who really was the original Jesus. And what I found from the study of the gospels is that the original gospel was prophet and Messiah. Now, it would be a different thing if Jay were to come and look into the Quran and find out that initially the Quran used to say that Jesus is the Son of God. That initially the Quran used to say that Jesus is the second person of the Holy Trinity. That initially the Quran used to say that Jesus is a crucified Messiah. And that Muslims changed it. But I don't think that Jay can make that point. Not even with these manuscripts he talks about from Sana'a or from anywhere else. Now, the Quran has information which is also quoted in other writings which are said to be apocryphal by Christians. But notice this. What Jay was quoting from had nothing to do about Jesus. It had to do with Solomon and Abraham and how does that establish our topic tonight? Notice something further. According to the proper definition of what is Torah as revealed to Moses, it includes both the written Torah and the oral Torah. The oral Torah was eventually collected and is now available in the Targums. If that is false, it is probably false because Moses got it false. But if Moses didn't get it false, then what they have now in the Targums is probably true until proven false. And if that is probably true, then what the Quran has, if it is the same thing, is also probably true, and you cannot prove the Quran to be false in that way. So now to sum up. These manuscript variants that Jay is talking about does not really prove anything because Muslims have compiled the Quran right from the very start. They have memorized the book from beginning to end so that today all over the world the Quran is read and it is the same book. Muslims do not have two or three different Qurans. On the other hand, Christians have four Gospels in which Jesus has been modified over time. You can see as you go from Mark to John that Jesus has changed, and I've given you quotations from a reputable scholar, Bruce Metzger, to demonstrate these things. Like, for example, the title Son of God is inserted later on, that the title Father is inserted later on, that they magnified the miracles of Jesus, that they covered up the limitations of Jesus, that they called Jesus Lord, they made people pray to Jesus, and they increased the knowledge of Jesus, they blurred the distinction between Jesus and his God. That is what has happened with the Gospels, so that Jesus emerged from prophet as he really was to Son of God that he would never accept to be. And so in conclusion, Jesus as prophet in the Quran is the true Jesus, and that is the Jesus I commend to you.
Now both of our debaters will do their final closing 12 minutes, starting with Jay Smith, and then we'll go to the question and answer period. Mr. Smith, you have 12 minutes, and Mr. Ali, you have 12.